Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. In the weeks following a recent spate of teen suicides attributed to bullying and alienation, there's been an emerging landscape of caring, if you will. Public gatherings, celebrity pep talks, and educational film screenings all contribute to a wave of support for kids who grow up feeling marginalized. Well, today, we'll meet three individuals who are fostering tolerance in kids, in school, and in communities at large by shaping their own stories and the stories of others whose lives have been impacted by fear, discomfort, and at times misdeeds of others. Our guests on today's show are Susan Wheeler, Maureen Costello, and Michael Fallon. First, we're going to hear from Susan Wheeler. She's a mother of seven children who she raised in rural Pennsylvania. Her son, Jim, committed suicide in 1997 after being bullied for being gay. His story was told in the 2003 film Jim in Bold. She joins us by phone. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for the privilege of being with you.
Yeah, I appreciate your time. Later on, we're going to hear from Maureen Costello. She's the director of Teaching Tolerance at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And in the third segment, we'll hear from psychologist Michael Fallon. He's got a one-man show that he performs in schools that addresses issues of tolerance. And we'd like to hear from you today. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Susan, when we spoke with you before the show, the first thing you said was that you grew up in central Pennsylvania. Why is that the first thing?
Probably because this I wouldn't call the most progressive area as far as tolerance for diversity is concerned. We're kind of, I would say, behind the times compared to your area, definitely.
Hmm. And what makes that significant? What kind of impact has that had for you, for Jim?
Well, I think it had a tremendous impact on Jimmy because he was not one to stay in the closet back in the 1990s when he grew up. He, in his poem, Jim in Bold, if you've read that, he desperately wants to come out and he wants people to see him for who he is. He's a young gay male. And I think closeting himself was very detrimental to him in many, many ways, but coming out was even worse.
Yeah, well, it's detrimental to most. When did he come out?
He came out about 1994, 1995, when he was in high school. He came out to us before that, but he came out mostly in high school to his peers and to the school at large.
Had he been bullied before that?
No, not to my knowledge. This more came out, the bullying really started when it was obvious he was different, he was gay, and in this area it was new, it was not tolerated well, and there was a backlash in various areas of his life, mostly in school.
Hmm. When he came out to his peers in school, how did he do it?
I think it was obvious. He dressed differently. He had a flair. He was artistic. He had some gestures in his style and in his dress that are not what you would call butch, the typical masculine gestures of the athletic types. And I think people perceived that and saw that he was maybe effeminate and grasped that and pretty much made fun of him and tormented him quite a bit.
How so?
Well, I would call it like pinpricks. You go through school every day, and you're called names. You're called names like fairy, sissy, you know, all the various names that go along with being different. And no one is there to stick up for you, except maybe a few friends. And I think, and then he had an episode, which we did not find out till later on, that happened in the shower where he was thrown down and he was urinated on. And
he didn't tell you about that.
No, he didn't. No. No, he didn't.
Do you know why?
You know, that's been a problem for me, because I've tried to keep a close relationship with all my children. But I guess I come to many ideas. First of all, I guess if you're bullied, maybe you don't want to share all these details. I guess that's coming out, that the people that are bearing the brunt of it don't want their parents necessarily to get involved. And we would have been very much involved. We would have gone to the school and really raised the roof on this. And maybe it would have brought more attention to him and made things worse at that time.
Well, I'm sure that was one of his fears.
Yes. I mean, I can only guess, but we did not know about it.
What about his siblings? How did they react when he came out and going forward? They were a whole variety of ages and different kinds of kids, I imagine.
That's very well put. We are a hodgepodge family. and yet, he was accepted and loved, and he was one of us. There wasn't any question, why is he this way? Maybe he could change. His older sisters absolutely loved him and did everything they could for him. His brothers the same. And the younger siblings, he did more for them. I mean, he was like an uncle. There was an age difference there. He took them places. He was definitely a part of our family, unconditionally cared for. So there wasn't a problem. It was the outside world that was very tough for Jimmy to deal with.
Well, Susan, the name of our show is Voices in the Family, and we call it that for a reason. And Jim didn't have a voice. He found a voice through poetry.
Yes, he did.
So the documentary, Jim in Bold, was based on a poem he wrote by the same name. What was his poetry like?
His poetry was, I would say, almost cathartic in nature, since he was so much kept so much inside through his artwork. His painting and his poetry is where he got all of his frustration, all of his anger, all of his innermost heartfelt feelings out. And it is just, I think it's beautifully written, even though he's my son. I think it reaches your very soul because it tells what the kind of pain that Jimmy was in and what he was going through.
Give us a feel for it. We asked you to read a segment of a poem he wrote entitled Timeline of a Faggot.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Thank you. This is when he was in gym class. I guess I found myself in gym class. I was kind of forced into this role. Didn't have a chance to hesitate, a fleeting moment to look back and rinse off the soap scum. I was thrown out of the shower, thrown down to the floor, dethroned with the name Sissy. Next came my dumb confession that I couldn't kick the balls, but I could probably find another use for this golden rope, not used to climb or rise to higher levels. I could use this to tack up my latest tag, fairy. Another step in rising above, it may be more like overcoming maybes of trying to be butch, but I really condescend as I extend my longest finger and walk the shuttle run. I broke taboos like mirrors in my face and returned the favor to my favorite jock four. That a closer to politically correct nickname came my way, Homo. Then I knew it was time for war. I bought all new armor and a punk rock attitude.
This kind of rage we hear in the poetry.
There is.
Did you see evidence of that?
Yes, I did at home. Yes, I did. I would see him come in the house, and he had a bedroom in the basement. And I'd say, how was your day, Jim? And he'd slam the door and he'd go down. And it was really hard for me to get him to talk to me and to open up. But I had enough teenagers to know that it is hard to get teenagers to talk to you at times.
Many kids who are bullied don't even feel that rage fully.
Mm-hmm.
Don't even know how rageful they feel. When I looked over a lot of Jim's writing. Some of it represented great self-loathing, pretty typical of not just gay and lesbian youth, but anybody who's bullied.
I think so, and I think he felt I think because of his sexuality and the time period that he came out, he felt like he was a freak of nature. He couldn't fit in. This was the problem. He had no real friends at school. He didn't fit into a church or a religion. We weren't attending a meeting here at a regular basis, unfortunately.
Your background is Quaker, yeah?
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, there aren't any Quaker meetings here in Lebanon. And there wasn't a place where Jim could go and find, these are people like me. This is a foundation for me. Here's a support system.
Susan, Jim committed suicide over 10 years ago after many years of living with bullying and discrimination. Did he talk to you about his depression and his hopelessness?
I could see it, but he never really talked about it. He always tried to put on a happy face. He tried to just disguise a lot of this and keep this to himself. I think it, you know, before he died, he had the tattoo Hope put on his, the symbol for Hope on his shoulder. And I really do believe that he somehow hoped he could pull it all together and not have to do this final thing. But he just, he couldn't take it. He was very sensitive. And I think, as I said, all the pinpricks, they're cumulative. They add up after a while, and then you can't fight anymore.
How are you? You and the family?
I think we're doing well, and I say that because we're lucky in that Equality Forum and Malcolm Lazen gave us this opportunity to do this documentary, and in a way I think that was very therapeutic for all of us because we could say to the world, we love this guy unconditionally, and his sexuality was not his choice. I could no more have made him straight than I could have made my other six children gay. And I felt that was an important message to educate, especially the straight community, that homophobia is very deadly and words can kill.
Well, speaking of education, we're going to take a short break now, Susan. And when we come back, we're going to hear from Maureen Costello. She's the director of Teaching Tolerance at the Southern Poverty Law Center in Alabama, and they've got a new tool for teaching tolerance. It's also a film about a major legal victory for gay students. And Susan, after that, we'll continue our conversation with you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Heart Institute, where doctors perform a new life-saving procedure in post-cardiac arrest patients. The process, known as therapeutic hypothermia, lowers the body's temperature to 93 degrees and is instrumental in saving vital brain functions. Part of the Cooper Resuscitation Center, therapeutic hypothermia has been used to provide specialized care to cardiac arrest patients throughout South Jersey. For information on how Cooper is advancing medicine in South Jersey, cooperhealth.org/numbers or 800-8-COOPER.
Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards used to sleep with a tape recorder and a guitar by his bed. One morning, he woke up to find he'd recorded something after he went to sleep. He played the tape and found the idea for the song that became Satisfaction.
And after that, there's 40 minutes of me snoring.
Keith Richards talks about his new autobiography on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today we're talking about cultivating tolerance and acceptance of one another in light of the several recent examples of bullying and public humiliation. In a little bit, we'll return to our conversation with Susan Wheeler. Her son's story about growing up gay in rural Pennsylvania was depicted in an independent film 7 years ago. But now I'm joined by Maureen Costello of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has just released the documentary called Bullied, A Student, A School, and A Case That Made History. Maureen joins us by phone from her office in Alabama. Maureen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Maureen, the suicide rate among gay teens is disturbingly high, and gay and lesbian teens are four times more likely to contemplate suicide. So your title is the Director of Teaching Tolerance. This is a major commitment of SPLC. So tell us, what's your job?
Well, my job is to work with teachers and schools across the country to build more inclusive environments, environments in which every student feels welcome and valued. We do that by publishing articles in our magazine, by doing lessons that teachers can use from K to 12, and by making films like Bullied.
All right, so let's talk about this film, Bullied. I want to listen to a clip, and it's mm-hmm. it's from the very end of the film where mm-hmm. where the teacher and Jamie Nabosny are explaining the impact the verdict will have. Give us some background on the film.
Jamie had been a student in Wisconsin and had been bullied throughout middle and high school. He was gay, although in middle school he had not come out yet, certainly to his friends. His parents had tried to intervene, and he himself had reached out to administrators and to teachers, and essentially nothing was done to stop the bullying. And so, of course, what started out as name-calling progressed over time to actually being physical beatings. Jamie went through all the kinds of reactions that you would expect, depression, trying to avoid school. He ran away. He attempted suicide. He finally did get his parents to agree to just let him leave school. When he did, he was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And only as part of his healing later did he decide that he had to put a stop to this in some way, and so he decided to sue his school district. And it's that story that we're telling in the film.
So he decided to sue his school district. How did that go? How did that unfold?
Well, initially, the case was thrown out. It was thrown out by the court that basically said, don't be ridiculous. You can't sue your school district for being bullied. And on appeal, and on the basis of sexual orientation, that is, and on appeal, a federal court said, yes, you can. Sexual orientation is, you know, discrimination based on sexual orientation is just as severe as discrimination based on anything else. You deserve the equal protection of the law. You'll have your day in court.
So let's listen to that to
sure.
that clip now.
Kudos to the brave young man who did the right thing and stood up for himself. Because in one young brave man standing up, he maybe inadvertently stood up for millions of others. The other thing that happened from this is that our school district is a better place. Jamie did have a lot to do with it. You know, if somebody holds a mirror up and forces you to take a good hard look at yourself, you're going to come away changed.
So a lot of people ask me, why did I do this? Why did I fight? And I'll tell you why. I fought back for all the kids who can't fight back. I get a lot of people contacting me on Facebook, kids that are being harassed, asking for help or advice. And I think the big lesson to be learned from all of this is that you have to fight back when something isn't right. It doesn't matter if you're gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or if you're harassed for any reason, you have a right to be protected in school and you have a right to have a safe education. I was a poor gay kid from northern Wisconsin, and I was able to stand up and say, harassment is wrong. Beating me up and urinating on me is wrong, and I won. And if I can do that, anyone can do that. Thank you.
That was from the new film that's being released by the Southern Poverty Law Center called Bullies. So we heard from Jamie Nabosny about why he did what he did. What was the final verdict, Maureen?
The final verdict was to award Jamie $900,000. And the school district not only paid that, but they did make changes. And I've spoken to people in Ashland, Wisconsin. It is a changed place, I understand. It is a school that has really stepped up to the plate, a district that stepped up to the plate and now really makes an effort to protect all of its students.
How?
They have anti-bullying policies that specifically include sexual orientation and gender expression, and they do training of teachers so that everybody is aware of that this is just not right and is not acceptable.
Do you think this is going to have an impact, this verdict will have an impact beyond this school district?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that this verdict was actually 14 years ago. So that you raise a fascinating question. Clearly, it has not had the impact that we would like in that it did not stop the bullying. And some people would argue that the bullying has gotten worse. It's also a verdict limited to the 7th District. However, in cases across the country, more and more schools are being held liable, whether under the 14th Amendment or under state laws or under other kinds of legal justifications. They are being held liable for protecting or for failing to protect students. So one of the messages we were giving in the film was to kind of say to administrators, look, this is a legal responsibility. But, of course, we really feel that it's much more than a legal responsibility. It is our core responsibility as educators to keep all of our children safe and to provide them with the optimal access to education. And a child who is afraid of going to school is not going to be as fully attentive and able to be educated, and that is the essential purpose of school.
Is there any way of measuring what impact this film will have?
Well, that's a great question, too. We're doing a kind of informal survey among people who are showing the film, but in fact we do plan to do a study early next year to kind of get a sense. And what we're really looking at is asking the question, in your school, has there been kind of serious discussion about this issue? Do you see a change in climate? Have you seriously looked at your policies? Have you made a larger effort to make sure that every teacher recognizes anti-gay slurs as a form of bullying? We do plan a study.
What about your other work? I know you at the Southern Poverty have been devoted to teaching tolerance and understanding for many years. A dear friend of the show and a personal friend of mine, Gerda Weissman Klein, is featured in the teaching kit, One Survivor Remembers.
That's right.
And that's been widely distributed throughout schools. Is there any way of knowing the impact of this kind of work?
Well, we have done some research in the past, and certainly these things are hard to measure because you're looking at dispositions and sensibilities. At the end of the day, what we're really trying to do is gain acceptance among children of each other and deepen their empathy, certainly, for the other. I like to think, you know, teaching tolerance has been around for 20 years, and certainly we've seen some major generational differences that suggest that this rising generation is more tolerant about issues of race and sexual orientation and religion than generations that have preceded them. So I'd like to think that we have something to do with that.
Tell us, much of your work, if not all of it, is focused on schools, but, you know, the problem obviously goes beyond schools. It goes into families. And I wonder what happens when kids are learning tolerance and compassion in school and they go home to parents who are prejudiced and anxious and homophobic.
Mm-hmm. You know, we at one time in the program did attempt to, you know, talk to parents as well and realize that our strength is in the education system, mm-hmm. and talking to teachers. But, you know, that's an issue, but I think it's one that children learn as, you know, they go to school. We all learn in a way to, you know, code switch so that, you know, we talk one language at home and sometimes we learn to talk mm-hmm. another language at school. And if at least we can say, hey, you know, we don't want to disrespect your family, but recognize that in the larger world, you need social skills that tolerance and understanding are part of. It's a delicate balance. Certainly we encourage schools to also involve parents so that you're getting that lesson across, but that's what you talk about is a tough situation.
Mm. Well, one of the things I admire so about these programs is that they try to empower people who don't have a voice. At the very least, people without a voice feel acknowledged and recognized. But in the process, is there a risk of demonizing the bullies?
I hope not. We don't want to demonize anybody. And in fact, I think that is certainly an issue that a lot of folks are working on, which is really how do you convert the bullies? You know, right now, most anti-bullying work focuses on empowering the bystanders and, of course, empowering the victim. Bullying is so much about power. Bullies feel very, very empowered, and there's a lot of evidence that suggests that they just kind of feed their power through bullying. And, of course, when you harass somebody else, every little word and every action takes power away from them and makes them feel weaker. So a lot of the work is really on empowering the victim and really empowering the bystanders so that they become upstanders. I think some more work has to be done, though, on also understanding the bully, who, in fact, that morning may have been bullied, and helping them to develop that kind of sense of empathy. I think there's also been some suggestion that the problem with bullies is that they truly don't understand or don't feel that empathetic connection and don't understand that other people really bleed when they, you know, when they harass them. And so working with the bullies is part of it, too. And recognizing, I think it was Mother Teresa who pointed out that, you know, there's a little bully in all of us. There's a little evil in all of us. You can't, it's not a black and white world. We have to accept that there's something good about those folks and work to, you know, expand on that.
Hmm. Good point. Well, Maureen, I know you have to leave. Your time frame is short. I really want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dan.
Maureen Costello of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has just released the documentary called Bullied, A Student, A School, and A Case That Made History. Thanks again, Maureen. And now we're back with Susan Wheeler. Her son Jim took his own life in 1997 after years of being bullied for being gay. His story was told in the 2003 film Jim in Bold. Susan, I'm curious. I spoke with Maureen about the bully and what it was like to be the bully. I wonder what your reaction was to that, what it was like as you were listening.
Well, you know, part of me feels very sorry for the bully, because I guess the bully is part of a victim of maybe a cycle in a family, I would think. Probably that child goes home and in turn is bullied, and then maybe their parents were bullied. So I guess you have to stop the chain somehow. And maybe with having a peer group and students stand up to the bully and show him some empathy, maybe I'm trying to paint it too much of a rosy picture. Maybe that's how you would change that person, through some kindness and sitting him down and trying to get to the root of his problem so he doesn't, in turn, do it to other people.
That is how most of us change. It starts with kindness.
Right, and that's where I would start. The people that did this to Jim, it's reprehensible what they did to him, and I abhor it, but on the other hand, I'm sure they've seen it someplace in their lives. And the people that stood by and watched it, I also feel sorry for them, too, because they didn't do anything to stop it. I mean, I think we're all in this together as a community, and in order to stop the bullying, we have to attack it from all sides.
I'm interested in language, and, you know, all of this work about teaching tolerance in order to diminish bullying and stigma, but it's the word tolerance. There are many of us in the minority community who say, we don't want to be tolerated. We want more than tolerance. We want to be accepted for who we are. And maybe what needs to be tolerated is those who discriminate need to learn to tolerate their own discomfort, their own anxiety.
Well, and you've turned it around and put it on their shoulders, which is a good thing to do, because basically maybe it's kind of their problem to work through, more so than our problem to make them happy with us, which I guess is a good way. They have to solve this problem for themselves, and it puts the burden on them.
Yeah, and we could help with our kindness, too.
Yes, and also with education.
Right, right.
With education, and I do believe education is a key, and that was one of the big reasons we did the documentary. To dispel all these rumors that people would just all of a sudden decide to be different or decide a lifestyle and it's just like Marie mentioned, a lot of it's empathy. Being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and say, gee, this must be tough, and I'm not necessarily tolerating it. I'm just saying, wow, I can see where they're coming from, and that's a whole different ballgame.
I am curious about something. This might be a painful question, but what was it like for you when you heard about the death of Tyler Clementi, the Rutgers student who committed suicide after being bullied and humiliated by some other students?
Well, I can be really honest with you. I felt the same pain in my heart that I had when I lost Jimmy. I really did. On NPR the next day, I heard his music teacher, I heard the community, I heard, I can't tell you. I can only imagine what the family is going through right now, losing their son. He was a bright, shining star, as are all of our youth, whether they be gay or straight, and this is a huge loss. And I think we all should feel it that way, and that's how I took it. It was very, and I wish there was some way to reach out to the parents, but I know this must be a very tough time for them.
Before we have to say goodbye to you and go to our break, could you ever imagine the day when homophobia would go away?
I can. I'm an eternal optimist. I can. I can see huge changes in the last 10 years since Jimmy died. Huge step forward. And this, talking to Maureen Costello and that documentary, that was fantastic. What this young man did to stand up to the school system and to actually have the legal system work with him and to do it on proper channels, I see that as a huge step forward. We have the marriage coming through. We have gays in the military. It won't be in my lifetime, Dan, but I think someday. Maybe it'll be a non-issue, and that's what we can all hope and pray for.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. Susan, we have to go. I've got three words for you. Bless your heart.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Dan. It's been an honor and a privilege.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure for me and great for our listeners. Thank you so much. That was Susan Wheeler speaking with us. Her son Jim took his own life in 1997 after many years, too many years, of being bullied for being gay. His story was told in the 2003 film Jim in Bold. Well, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Michael Fallon. He's a psychologist and actor whose one-man show, You Don't Know Me Until You Know Me, addresses issues of race, discrimination, violence prevention, and personal identity. If you want to join our conversation with Michael, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Association of Delaware Valley Independent Schools, ADVIS, supports WHYY and offers opportunities to learn about its 140 member schools in the tri-state region on advis.org. Independent private schools define their own missions and work to inform parents about their intimate communities that nurture strengths and interests, develop character, and prepare students not only for college but for life. For information about the region's independent private schools, it's advis.org.
Boardwalk Empire is the new HBO series from filmmaker Martin Scorsese, and it's a tough and often bloody portrayal of Prohibition-era Atlantic City. But one of the talents responsible for creating this macho landscape of gangsters and booze is one of the top female talents in Hollywood. We'll hear her story next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Thank you.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about discrimination, prejudice, and bullying, and how to deal with it most effectively, how to make our own children and our hopefully ourselves more humane. We'll be talking with this segment with Michael Fallon. He's a psychologist and actor whose one-man show, You Don't Know Me Until You Know Me, addresses issues of race, discrimination, violence prevention, and personal identity. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be on.
So I hear the words psychologist, actor, and one-man show. And before we get into any of the content here, I got to know a little bit about Michael, because I'm a psychologist too. So, you know, it's the way my mind works. So you started acting when you were 11, and I imagine you were pretty good. So why go into psychology? Why not acting?
That's what you call Jamaican parents who had education first, and they refused to pay for college education if it was going to be for theater. But in high school, I discovered that I really enjoyed psychology as well, so then there was a natural leaning for me to be able to get a degree in something that was approved by my parents, but then to be able to do something as well in college and on the stage.
With all due respect, your parents weren't Jamaican. They were probably Jewish and never told you. It's just a guess.
Yes.
So why this direction? Teaching tolerance and combating discrimination, and why via a one-man show?
Well, you know, I was just listening before, and when you had Susan on, and I realized that the word tolerance for me is kind of like the next step, but it's a step away from the ultimate goal of inclusion and understanding and embracing differences rather than just the tolerance of it. I chose theater because for me, when I was growing up, I was always fascinated by people who were able to perform and capture my attention in a way that was beyond the lecture spectrum, you know, where someone's just telling me what I need to do.
One of my concerns is that is about words, you know, and like you said, lectures, and the research shows that words really don't have much of an impact on behavior change, and we as psychotherapists know that metaphor has a big impact. Metaphor tends to penetrate defenses and open up new lines of thinking in the brain.
Yes. I find that when I'm on stage and playing these roles, that the best part, the best compliment I ever get is when the children or the adults come up to me and say, "You made me think about this. I know it was unrelated to your show, but it made me think about this in my life."
Give us a sense of what your shows are like.
Okay, so I combine my trainings in psychology and acting, and what I do is put on a one-man show of sorts that combines motivational speaking, comedy, stand-up comedy, as well as multi-character roles that I get into. And the idea behind You Don't Know Me Until You Know Me is creating characters that will make people laugh and then quickly turn around to make them deeply feel or think in a way that perhaps they haven't been thinking before.
So one of the characters you portray is a football player, a tough guy who's also gay.
Yes.
Let's get to know him. Tell us about him or be him.
His name is Octavius Furious Malone, and he is the star athlete when he was in high school, and now he's at college. And it's interesting because I went to graduate school at Rutgers. I use Rutgers as the college that he's going to as a redshirted freshman, and which comes so timely with everything with the Tyler Clemente situation. But what he does is as I speak in that character, he draws the audience in, particularly males that are, the, you know, what they call the jocks in the audience, and have a very stereotype of who is really man enough, you know, to play football. And so Octavius pushes these buttons because he's a star black athlete, tough guy, if you will. And then he turns around and says, you know, I wear a mask every day because what I'd really want to tell some of my friends is that I'm gay. And you know, and what happens in the audience is this reaction of, you know, people take a deep breath in and they try to understand him.
You are Octavius, right? You are Octavius in this one man play.
I am the character Octavius. So then what happens is I bounce from a little boy, a 6-year-old boy, right into Octavius. So people first hear
me speaking with a 6-year-old little boy voice, and they have no idea what's about to happen.
And then all of a sudden, it's like, my name is Octavius Furious Malone. And immediately, there's like this laughter and appreciation of the stereotypical player, black male, that's going to be speaking.
And then the change.
Then the change.
Yeah. What happens? You must get a wide variety of reactions.
Wide variety, absolutely. It's interesting. I think for some people, they start to identify with Octavius, and then once he comes out that he's gay, they immediately shut down. I mean, I've seen very visual examples of this where mostly males will then kick up their feet on top of the seats in front of them and just pretend they're going to go to sleep or literally go to sleep. And then I've heard others that get more drawn in. So I watch students who will later come to me who are gay, lesbian, bi, or transgender, and they will come to me and say that was a character really spoke to them, and thank you so much for not playing the stereotype. And then I'll get anger. I will have from some of the, mostly males again, who will shout out, you know, derogatory terms towards gays right there as I'm performing, or I will have some religious figures coming to me and saying, I enjoyed your show, but I didn't agree with your character, which is always a puzzling statement to me.
Yeah, it really is interesting. I'm going to have to ask you to put your psychologist hat on for a minute, if you don't mind, because we've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Okay?
Sounds good.
We've got Sarah on the line. Sarah, hi. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. So I was actually bullied a fair amount in high school and middle school, and one thing that I found was that my school was very good at dealing with it once they were informed of it. They were never good at spotting it, though. It's like it had to get to the point where I went to my mom and then we went to the school before they would notice or do anything about it. And I was just wondering, you know, what is/can be done to maybe help out with this.
Well, Michael, that's part of what you're doing, and it's part of what we heard from both Susan Wheeler and Maureen Costello is about educating schools for preventive purposes. Yes, Michael?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That's partly why I'm brought into it. It's usually before the crisis happens, just to bring awareness and to humanize issues that get categorized as either unknown or scary.
Yeah, I wonder, Susan, Sarah, thanks so much for your call, and I'm happy your school at least was responsive. I mean, there's many schools who aren't even responsive once it comes to their attention. I wonder, Michael, what schools call you in? I wonder if the schools that need you the most aren't calling you.
That's a great question. You know, sometimes I have found that there are school districts that have, because I also address a lot about suicide, so I find it very interesting. There are some school districts that have some biased actions going on there that don't call me because they feel they don't need me or the perception that they don't need me. And I think what happens when I get labeled as a diversity speaker, they look at their population and they say, well, we're not diverse, so we don't need this speaker, where my idea of diversity is quite large in that. And then there are some schools that are just very resistant, especially in dealing with anything dealing with homosexuality or transgender issues.
Yeah, and they're the ones who would benefit the most. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Susan on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Dr. Dan. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a 60-year-old gay woman. I live just outside of Philadelphia in a small community that is not gay-friendly. And in high school, I am sorry to say, I was a bully. And I was a bully because my self-worth was so bad that the only way I could make myself feel better was to make sure that I could put somebody down and make them feel worse.
Did you come out? Were you out in high school?
I've always known I was gay, but I didn't actually come out until I moved away from this area and got into a big gay community and realized that I wasn't the only one in the world. There wasn't really anything wrong with me. And then I realized what I had done all through my teenage years, and I'm terribly ashamed about it, but don't know quite what to do. But I think sometimes the bully sometimes just is so damaged themselves that they lash out, and that's how they lash out.
I want to address one thing that you said when you said you're terribly ashamed of and you don't know what to do. There really is lots you can do. You know, check out the Southern Poverty Law Center and take a look at that program they're doing. See, I have always believed, and I believe it deeply, Susan, that the path to mental health and well-being is through the pursuit of social health. And that if you can make a heartfelt devotion to making things better, I think it'll make you feel better. I'm confident it'll make you feel better. I don't know how that fits into your lifestyle, your schedule, so on and so forth, but it's just a thought. Michael, I want to hear your reaction to what Susan's saying about the bully. Can we generalize about what she's saying, that they're suffering inside, that they don't, in fact, feel powerful, they feel powerless?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, when I go to, I mean, I do a variety of schools, and sometimes I go to schools where it's a specialized population. So, for example, I'll go to a school where all the students have severe physical disabilities. And even in those schools where all of them have been picked on in the public sector, they will pick on each other, and there will be a hierarchy. There will be the child who walks with a limp but doesn't have a wheelchair, who makes fun of the child who's in a wheelchair. And so it is an issue of power and feeling powerless that I think what happens for those who are classified as the bully, as well as fear of just not a fear of those things that aren't understood.
I want to tell you my personal experience, and maybe this is an adult thing and wouldn't work for children, but you know, I'm the guy in the wheelchair, and since I've been in a wheelchair for 30 some years, I have found that my vulnerability, when I'm open about it, when I talk about my vulnerability, elicits compassion and not discrimination. It gets just the opposite reaction of what people would expect. But I don't know if that would work for a school child.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think that's partly what I do is humanize. I put the complex version of what is often seen as the stereotype. So all my characters, you know, can be labeled or mislabeled in the stereotype realm. And one of the things that I point out in my show is that we need to go back to first grade and relearn the lesson that we learned all too well, and that was when the teacher handed out the piece of paper that had animals and objects on it and told us to find the things that were different and cross them out. We need to relearn that lesson, to put a smiley face next to them. You know, we were very impressionable at that first grade time, and when we started crossing things out, we generalized it by third grade. to be able to cross each other out in the hallways.
Yeah, it is so true. You're right. We need to, in life, I think we need to relearn those lessons we learned in childhood. Small children don't discriminate. They don't see difference. And if they do, it's interesting to them, and they're genuinely curious about it. And sadly, we forget those lessons.
Yes.
Life does that to us. Are you keeping pretty busy?
I keep very busy.
Well, that makes me happy. You're getting a lot of calls to do your one-man show?
Yes, and schools and different organizations and branching out into different arenas that I feel that it's not just for kids. Obviously, the issues of discrimination and bias attacks.
Well, we have to go, but let's hope you get lots of work, and let's hope that it has a great impact. Thanks so much for the work you do, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
Michael Fallon's a psychologist and actor whose one-man show, You Don't Know Me Until You Know Me, addresses issues of race, discrimination, violence prevention, and personal identity. Well, early on, we heard from Susan Wheeler, who shared her story about her son, Jim, whose shortened life is depicted in the documentary Jim in Bold. And we also heard from Maureen Costello earlier on. She's the director of Teaching Tolerance at the Southern Poverty Law Center in Alabama. Well, next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about truth and trust during the election season. Yes, there is such a thing as truth and trust. We're going to see if we can find some. Also, on Thursday the 4th, I'm going to be giving a lecture entitled, Is Happiness Necessary? Come out and I'll tell you the answer. It's at the Transformation Holistic Learning Center in Voorhees. You can go to readytotransform.com for more information, or go to my website at drdangottlieb.com. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. For always interested in your ideas or comments about the show. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. We're going to say goodbye for a couple of months while she has a baby. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. Maggie Zahn is our new intern. Welcome, Maggie. And we say goodbye to Sherry Siegel, our past intern. You've been wonderful. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.